Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It's Christmas Eve. It's been a busy past few days and experienced some of the worst traffic in my life yesterday. L.A. and rain and the day before Christmas Eve do not go well together, just for future reference. Anyway. I thought today would be a great day to, you know, because it is the holiday season, why not talk about an unsolved murder? So for that, I bring in Jen. Jen, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. Nothing gives you the warm cozies like a murder.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I appreciate you spending some time on Christmas Eve.
Honey, there is no one else I'd rather spend Christmas Eve with. Come on.
There you go. So today is a, you know, if you... In this case, it's kind of weird because the parents are more famous than the one who was killed. And we're talking about the death of Karen Kupsnet. And why don't you tell us a little bit about Karen?
All right. November 1963, this is going to be a West Hollywood murder. She was 22 years old, and she, too, was an aspiring actress and model, and kind of like a lot of the girls that we've talked about. You know, she had some bit parts here and there and even two movie roles. But, you know, she wasn't anybody that was huge. So she was discovered strangled in her Monterey Village apartment. And it was on North Switzer Avenue. Do you know where that is?
I do. It's a little bit south of Sunset, and actually a little bit south of Fountain where she died. Sorry, anybody who wants to know. So, and yeah, it's a very one of this. I'm glad you brought that up first. And I know we're going to talk about it as a theory and something else later, but she lived there. She did not live in Oxnard, California, correct?
Correct. That's what makes everything to do with just the non-shortage of conspiracies that just surround her death, you know, and have surrounded it for years. This is why they don't make sense. And that's why I love bringing you into these stories, because, you know, we can point it out together as to why this stuff does not add up.
Yeah, it doesn't add up at all. And I, you know, just, but anyway, we'll get to that theory in a little while. But I just, you did not see anything where she lived in this West Hollywood apartment, correct? That's
correct.
The only place that she had. All right. Because I when I started reading the theory, and again, we'll talk about it and everybody, it makes a lot of, it's fitting a theory into a situation, I guess, is what it is. But, yeah, so Karen is the offspring of Irv Kupsnet, who is very famous in Chicago. He's got a bunch of Emmy Awards. He lived a very long life, died at the age of 91, and he had a weekly gossip column, actually, for about 60 years. So near and dear to my heart. And he was beloved. He also had a syndicated television talk show that he did for, God, 30 or 40 years, something like that. So Irv was able to provide Karen a lifestyle that other up-and-coming actresses would not necessarily be able to afford, which also, I think, gave her, I think a police detective said she had more friends than anybody he's ever met. And then nobody really had anything bad to say about her, but I would say that the number one suspect, well, number two suspect, probably had some bad things to say about her.
I agree. You know, the police can have their statement, but on the outside looking in, I see a couple of people that had some things to say about her. I mean, if you just look at her record just as an actress, those people had something to say. The suspects had something to say. There's no shortage of suspects in this case either. Even though, yeah, a couple of them look better than others, you know, there's just no shortage.
So Irv, also known as Cup around Chicago, I mean, this is a guy that would get invited to the White House. He knew everybody, A-plus list in Hollywood. I mean, A-plus, like Bob Hope was his friend, Bing Crosby, Danny Thomas, Joan Crawford. I mean, everybody. And he actually, so Jack Parr was the original host of The Tonight Show. And it was called America After Dark at that time, but it became The Tonight Show. And when Jack Parr left, Irv was one of the people that was a replacement until they could find a permanent replacement. And he did so well that they gave him he had his own talk show, and it ran from 1959 to 1986. So this is somebody who well-known, beloved in the city of Chicago. The daughter, well, let's talk about the wife, Irv's wife. A little bit different than Irv. And she was, would you call her a momager, a stage mom from hell?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. You know, Karen really, I don't think she had a chance, at least growing up. She had very rich parents who spoiled the hell out of her. And at the same time, Karen's mom wanted Karen to be an actress and was going to live through Karen. And one of the things that she decided that Karen was a little bit too heavy. And to me, when I look at pictures of Karen, she does not look heavy at all. But her mom thought that she was too heavy and introduced her daughter to diet pills.
What a mom.
Yes. Which at that time was just amphetamine. So it was essentially, you know, kind of an Adderall, but she was addicted to amphetamines from, I would say, probably high school aged until she died.
Well, she was only 5'1", so you have to be careful when you're shorter and you're a film actress or any type of model, because the weight can gang up on you very quickly, and it does look bad when you're that stature. However, she was gorgeous. I don't see anything wrong with her weight, but her mother did put her in like a mental prison when it came to weight, and she was just obsessed with it. She was abusing those diet pills, just taking way over the recommended dose, and it was making her crazy.
It was. She was a little crazy. She had an IQ at the genius level, which I'm not sure is really a good thing when you're also addicted to drugs and have this childhood trauma of this mom. Now, Dad, he did what he could to help out her career. And I would say that everything that she landed film and television wise was through her dad or her dad's connections.
Yeah, I agree. Everything was Dad's favor.
Yeah, everything. Not because here's part of the problem. Karen, in addition to being addicted to amphetamines, I think was addicted to plastic surgery. And we're talking plastic surgery in the 1960s, early 1960s. So a little bit, you know, the techniques were not necessarily as good as they are now. And so she had surgery on her chin, her nose, her ears, and her eyes. And it kind of, she wasn't able to emote at all. Because of what they had done. So she was a pretty bad actress. She could take a photo, but she was a really bad actress.
Yeah, they said she went so far on the plastic surgery that producers commented that she had lost her natural beauty and expressiveness on camera.
And then combine that with the way that she behaved on set with male actors. Just kind of, she wasn't going to get any roles except as a favor or if it was something that, you know, a walk on or one line, something that was, hey, Irv, we did, you know, you a favor. And, you know, there's also talk that Irv was mobbed up. I would say that's probably likely considering, did you see the person who identified Karen's body?
I did. And that did it for me. I was like, yep, he's mobbed up.
He is mobbed up. Jerry Korshak was the one who identified the body. He is a famous mob lawyer. And to me, that just says, okay, then Irv, if the one person that Irv's going to call when Irv's in Chicago and his daughter's in L.A. is he calls the mob lawyer. So, I mean, and the mob lawyer knew Karen well enough to be able to identify her.
Exactly.
So, you know, if, and Hollywood was really, you know, the mob was everywhere, the unions and things like that. So, if Irv wanted his daughter to get a role, some calls would be made, and then Irv's daughter would get a role. Not big ones. Nobody was, I don't even think that she wanted to be a huge star. I think that she just liked being in the industry, maybe.
Yeah, I think it's just one of that sixth grade separation from it. You know, have a few parts here and there to say that she had parts, you know, that she was an actress. And
yeah.
Aside from that, please mommy, maybe, because her mom was acting as the momager. And then other than that, she just wanted to go off with friends.
Yeah. And, you know, her parents paid for everything to the point where she lived in an exclusive apartment. This was an apartment that Cary Grant once lived in. when Cary Grant was a star. So not up and coming Cary Grant, but Cary Grant as a star. So this will kind of tell you what she was able to afford, you know, through the parents. And, you know, it's just that attracted a lot of people who wanted to hang out with somebody who had some money. Now, one of the roles that she got, she landed a show, an appearance on The Wide Country. And that's where she met the star of the series, a guy named Andrew Prine. And Andrew's still alive, I think, right?
Yeah, he's alive.
Yeah. And they began a relationship. And I will tell you this, that I am as confused as, not confused, because, but Andrew was, married when he met Karen.
I knew you were going to say that because I read that too, you know, and it wasn't till the end of the story that they brought up the so-called wife. And I thought, where does she come in? But it looks like he was married and in the process of going through in a divorce. That's my understanding. And then he was dating Karen because, you know, him and Karen go on to be photographs and, you know, splashed in magazines and stuff. And it wasn't salacious. So that makes me think that he was, in fact, divorced. Does that sound right?
Well, it does. And here's the thing. His wife, Sharon Farrell, she was having an affair with another actor. And the actor, I can only ever remember the TV show that he was in, but played Dr. Ben Casey. So he was one of the biggest stars in Hollywood at that time. And so Sharon and he were having an affair. And maybe that's the reason that Andrew and Sharon split. But he was definitely married. And Sharon and Andrew were only married and divorced within the same calendar year. And this is a time when divorce took a little while sometimes to happen, the finalization of it. So it's interesting. And then, you know, not to talk too much about Andrew's love life, but the next wife that he had was not the one that was the cause of the trouble between Karen and Andrew. It was another woman, and he ended up marrying her three separate times.
I guess you love who you love.
I guess, you know, and my guess is that maybe, you know, he was cheating on her all the time and they would, you know, split up and then get back together and split up and get back together again. And then he finally married somebody in the mid-80s and I think is still married to her.
That just seems like a lot of paperwork.
It does, doesn't it? It's just to do that. And I'm trying to think if anybody would have seen Andrew Prine in anything. I guess, you know, there was a show called V. It was a miniseries. And he was kind of a star in that. So maybe you saw him in V and then there was a sequel.
He tended to get better parts, you know, later on in life because he went on to have the bit roles in CSI and then, ironically, the Murder, She Wrote episode.
Yes.
So people might remember him more from something like that. I mean, he was a good looking guy.
Yeah. And, you know, and he's still around and, you know, he's in his 80s. So he's around anyway. So let's go back to Karen. And we had, so she meets Andrew. And the problem is that Andrew didn't want to make the relationship exclusive. Perhaps because he has just been in this marriage where his wife cheated on him. But at the same time, you know, he's, you know, sleeping with Karen and whoever else. And Karen is, from what I can gather, is only sleeping with Andrew. Would you agree?
Yeah, she believes that the two are exclusive, but he doesn't see it the same way because he thinks his career is on some type of upswing, which honestly it really wasn't. But he
didn't
want to be.
Wasn't.
Yeah, it wasn't. He didn't want to be tied down with her, and that angered her.
The same thing is he was using her because she knew everybody, and she could always get her photo in the magazines of the time. So, you know, he liked to be seen with her and, oh, you know, Andrew Prine, actor, dating, you know, Karen Gibsonette or whatever. But there was a time in July of 1963, so 4 months before she was killed, that she had an illegal abortion.
Yeah, she traveled to Tijuana, Mexico to have that abortion.
Yeah, and the person that took her was it Mark Goodman or Mark? Yeah, no, the Goddard. Anyway,
yeah,
it was
Goddards.
This guy who was in Goddard's. And he was in Lost in Space. That's how you maybe would know him. But again, Mark Goddard's dad was really, really good friends with Irv. So there's all these connections. So these people are getting met through Karen's dad and his relationships that he had established over the, you know, the 20 years prior to that. And yeah, the other thing is,
Andrew Prine's dating her. He's working his way basically through her daddy's black book. He is getting all these different connections. And then he just realizes, you know, hey, I'm finished with her. You know, she's taking me as far as she can possibly take me. You know, it's up to me from here. She goes off and gets the abortion in Tijuana because he doesn't like the idea of a baby. And it does seem like that she told him about it, because the conversation she has with not only him, but the Goddards is very telling. You know, how she goes on to even say that the baby's still alive, even though we know that she had an abortion. There's no way that there is a baby.
Yeah, that's really weird. That's the night that she died, right?
Yeah.
When she talks about the baby being left on the doorstep.
Exactly. Yeah, she started placing those calls to not only Prine, but to other people.
See, and then this is where, because she does all this stalking and the phone calls and all these kind of things, I can get. I mean, if you ignore the whole Oxnard part, and again, we'll talk about this theory in a little while. I get, kind of, because she's got some strange behaviors. And, you know, I can see how people want to make it work, even though it's not possible for it to work. But I'm not discounting that something happened that day that Kennedy was shot. I just, you know, anyway. So Andrew broke off the relationship with her. But she was obsessed. And she started stalking him. And she stalked him by cab because she never learned how to drive.
Exactly. That is the funny part about this. I mean, you can't not laugh, because she doesn't know how to drive. She never took it upon herself to learn how to drive or to get a driver's license. So she stalks him by cab. She starts showing up to everywhere that he is.
I know. And get this. So I'm imagining she gets a taxi cab ride and the driver, and she says, you know, just wait for me here, because then she goes to break into his apartment sometimes to wait for him. And then there was one time he showed up for a date and she hid in the attic. You know, just.
And then she wrote about it. That's the thing, is that she did not even try to cover her tracks. She wrote in her journal entry, "Me watched from the hedge. Awful.
Yes.
Nightmares. Wish I were dead."
So then she started sending him death threats, or threatening letters. And
have you seen those letters?
Yes. They don't. Here's what I don't understand. She took magazine words and put them together into sentences, but rarely does she come up with a coherent sentence.
That is true. But these things are crazy looking. I mean, it's like something a serial killer would send you. It's just like a mix of random alphabet letters that you would just cut out of a magazine. You just kind of paste it onto a sheet of paper.
One of the ones that she said was, "You will need protection." Ben Casey, again, talking about Dr. Casey, that show, Dr. Ben Casey. And even she refers to him as his character rather than his name. Caught message for your beau. You haven't much time for dreams. Now, I got to look up his real name. But anyway, we'll just call him Dr. Ben Casey. So remember, he's having an affair with Sharon, who is Andrew's wife. And so they're going through a divorce. And Andrew needs to be able to serve Dr. Ben Casey. So he gets Karen to do it for him. And this is, I think, after they split, which again, this whole timeline, but I'm going with that, you know, he was technically split with his wife and he's doing Karen or whatever. And so I think Karen did that thinking, okay, he's doing this so that way we can be together. And I think she took real offense that he was just using her and her ability to get on any television set.
Yeah, I agree.
Let's see. Oh, your lady needs surgery suddenly. Expect to get bad breaks wherever you go. Your rich beauty has no time. Are we talking about, you think, the abortion on that one?
Yeah, you know, it's telling what she writes. I don't know how she thought that people would not believe this was her, because everything about these sentences points to her. You know, talking about vanity, maybe hints of about the abortion, the broken English. I don't know why she talks like she is a foreign national.
I don't either. Are you going to Latin America or Florida? Let your beautiful virgin become lonesome and so easy to make. Bet K cup tastes as good as it looks. Blow. Perhaps it's some kind of poetry. Perhaps, I don't know. But again, in this thing that she is sending, she says bet K cup. So of course it's her doing it. She's identifying herself in the death threats.
Exactly. And also where she went wrong is that she used scotch tape to tape the letters down on the paper from the magazine. And, you know, tape is the perfect surface to lift fingerprints from, which is exactly what law enforcement did when they collected these letters. And the fingerprints traced right back to her shopping arrest. She was shoplifting, and they had fingerprinted her for that crime. And these fingerprints led right back to what was on the letter.
And she did get arrested for shoplifting, and I think it was a Capri pants, and I forget the other couple things that she stole. And obviously, she didn't need the money. So I think that she was just doing it for thrills.
Yeah, it's like a Winona Ryder complex.
Yeah, you know, attention.
She had the money. Yeah, she had some other need for why she did this stuff. You know, acting out.
So let's talk about, let's talk about what happened 6 days. It was 3 days after, but it was 6 days we found. But this was the same week that JFK was assassinated. So it gives rise later on to a theory that because the mob is, you know, thought to have been involved in JFK's assassination, and then you have Irv, and there is a theory about Karen. Another thing that I want here, this is crazy to me. So Andrew and her are split. She is stalking him. He wants nothing to do with her, you know, messages to, you know, let's send them over to the police, death threats, all this kind of stuff, because he's got this girlfriend and who was Hungarian, and her name's Anna Capri. The day that JFK was killed, Karen and Andrew were in Palm Springs together.
Yeah, so 6 days prior to her death, there is a death threat that comes in for JFK, who goes on to be assassinated. That was November 22nd at 10:07 a.m. A female caller based in Oxford, Camarillo, had dialed the operator because back then they didn't have 911 where you just picked up the phone and you got, you know, the police. You would get a phone operator who would patch you to someone else. So a female caller picked up and told the operator, you know, JFK is going to be shot. And then 20 minutes later, he was. And the female caller was never located. The FBI, they did an investigation and concluded that phone call lasted 10 to 15 minutes, and the voice was of a middle-aged woman. Okay, that already rules out Karen.
I know, and it came from Oxnard. And the way it's described, I guess, is this woman thought that her call had been, well, it was connected or whatever, but the operator stayed on the line and kind of heard that. And then there was an actual – this actually did happen. I mean, there is no disputing the fact that this call did occur.
Oh, yeah. It's a real call.
Yeah, it's a real call. And the Associated Press, you know, ran the story. When the FBI was investigating everything to do with the death, they found out about this. And, I mean, they went through phone records of people. But the problem was at that time, you could only tell where the call originated from via a city. So it was Oxnard, Camarillo, which – you know, touch each other, and they're in southern Ventura County, central Ventura County, and which is a long way from West Hollywood and even further away from Palm Springs.
Yeah, you had multiple witnesses that put her not even in that area code at all. You know, she was off with friends having fun, and she was nowhere near a telephone. And the FBI goes on to track down basically where they believe that the phone call came from. They're not sure. You know, that this part of the story is not completely fact-based, but they thought that it came from a judge's office.
Yeah, I saw that it came from a judge's office, which was bizarre. And then they interviewed some – and we can talk about that stuff. But the thing is that
– how Karen gets pulled into this is an author. Basically, he had heard the story about the phone call, which is a real-life phone call, and he decided that he had reasonable doubt – to believe that Karen looked good for this because she died of suspicious circumstances. You know, he said, oh, well, her father has mob ties and she died just, you know, just bizarrely. So it must have been her.
There were at that time, what somebody did was they found everybody who had been killed within a week or so of JFK. And then they put them in a list, and Karen's name was at the top of that list. As maybe this is something to do with JFK's death. And the whole theory about Karen was that her dad is mobbed up in Chicago, and that her dad knew Jack Ruby, and that Jack Ruby told Irv, and that Irv told Karen, and then the Karen just, you know, told somebody, was calling a friend to talk about it. So that's a lot of leaps.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the person did not do due diligence to pull her into something like that. And just the more they talked about it, the more angry her father got.
Also, at that time, the state mental institution was in Camarillo. So there is the possibility that some kind of patient there picked up a phone, and because there was talk that there was not just the Kennedy is going to get shot, that they were rambling on about other things, and that was just one of the items.
Yeah, the call is weird because the person goes on to mumble at the end of their statements the word thermostat, and then they go on to say the word thermostat wrong at least three times. So it does sound like there might be some type of mental issue there.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get to the night that she was killed. She went out to dinner with the Goddards, Mark and Marcia, and they said that her lips seemed numb, her voice was funny, she moved her head at odd angles, and that her pupils were constricted.
So yeah, everything about that night was weird. She showed up an hour late,
yes,
of course, by cab.
And then she told them the story about the baby that had been abandoned on her doorstep earlier that day. And Karen had told Andrew that same story. Nobody, I don't think that the police would have looked into that, and I doubt it happened. She's probably just referring to her abortion. And
yeah, I think she's mentally tripping out because these people knew that story wasn't true. After all, they had taken her to get the abortion.
So she leaves the party at 8:30 by cab again and goes home. And this is the night before Thanksgiving that this happened. And she tells the Goddards that she and Andrew were going to go to Glenn Ford's house the next day. But the police said, well, no, they weren't scheduled to go there at all. And then she had also told her parents that she wasn't going to go home for Thanksgiving because she had to work on the television show Perry Mason, which also wasn't true. She probably didn't want to see her mom.
Yeah, sounds like she's avoiding everyone because she's telling a series of white lies.
So she gets home, and a writer that she knew was waiting by the door. And he also didn't have a car, and he had walked to Karen's house from Beverly Hills, which, depending on where he lived in Beverly Hills, is really not that far, especially if you're used to not having a car or something like that. A couple of miles, maybe. I don't know where in Beverly Hills he was living, but I'm going to assume it was in the flats, and so probably a couple-mile walk. And the thing is, he wanted to go watch TV at her house because Karen, I think, had the nicest television in all of Los Angeles, it sounds like.
Yeah, sure, that state-of-the-art TV that her dad bought her. And
yes, exactly. So then everybody wanted to go to her house to watch television. So this guy Ruben is there. And remember, she left the party at 8:30. She takes a cab. She gets home. She sees Ruben. They go in. And then at 9, she says that she needs some fresh air and wants to go for a walk. I get the jittery part. The amphetamines are probably just, screwing around with her. So then she goes outside and she comes across this other actor named Robert Hathaway. And she invites him to come up and watch TV too. And Ruben and Hathaway are very good friends. They used to be roommates. And when they were roommates, they lived next door to Andrew Prine. So this is a group of people that all kind of know each other.
Yeah. It wasn't strange for them to hang out all the time, for them to show up at each other's homes.
I don't think it was. And, and he was waiting because, remember, there's no cell phone. So he probably thinks, well, she's going to get home eventually. And I want to watch some TV. But she did leave that party early. So he could have been waiting a long, long time for her to come. And to me, even though Ruben is not really a suspect, that whole thing where he's just waiting for her to come, I mean, and he could have been waiting for hour after hour after hour. Was that something that it just seemed kind of weird?
Yeah, it's weird to me, too. But yeah, the three of them, they go inside. They're having cake. They're having coffee. They're getting along. It seems like everything was OK. They were watching TV.
Yeah. And then she wakes up. She falls asleep in front of the couch, in front of the TV. She gets up and goes to her room and goes to sleep. And apparently Andrew returned home from a date with this Annika pre-person around midnight. But he called Karen and they spoke to each other. So I'm not sure if she had already gone to bed or if she went to bed after she spoke to him. Have you been able to clear that up at all?
It sounds like she was already lying down because the two guys that were keeping her company, they go on to leave at 11:15 p.m. and they were heading out to the Sunset Strip to grab a drink. And then she's asleep this time. When Prine comes back, you know, it's midnight. So he's done with his date. He calls her. I think he wakes her up. They said the phone call didn't last over 5 minutes.
Right. And you're right, because they left about 11:15. And so Andrew Prine 12. So he calls her, I guess. I mean, it's just kind of weird that he is calling her.
Yeah, you have his friends or friends that they share mutually over at her home. They leave, and then as soon as they leave, he's calling her.
Right. And they went to this club called the Raincheck Room, which had just opened. And if anybody's curious about it, it's not there anymore. It's now a restaurant called Nora. But Alex Rocco was one of the first bartenders there. And Alex Rocco was Mo from Godfather and famous Teddy Z. And he's in The Thing You Do and just – a great guy and just rain check room history there. So anyway, so then we don't hear anything from Karen at all. And 3 days later, the Goddards went to her apartment. Oh, before they left, the two guys, they lowered the volume on the TV, but they didn't turn off the TV. And 3 days later, it was still on. So the Goddards go over there and to check on her, and they found her naked body lying on the couch. And she has been dead the whole 3 days.
Yep, dead 3 days, lying face down on the couch. And there was several prescription bottles in the house that were not only empty, but just kind of disheveled, just kind of laying around.
Yeah, and also there was one that she had just got refilled 2 days ago, and all the pills were gone. So somebody, you know, took some of the pills, I guess. And that kind of, in a way, makes me, I don't know what the rules were on prescriptions back then, and if doctors just wrote them anyway. You know, maybe she was not getting them all legally. And, you know, there is the possibility that there was some kind of dealer or something like that. I don't know.
I'm sure. I mean, her dad knew everyone, which means she probably knew everyone. And if she wanted to get something, you know, she was a girl that knew how to get things.
And, you know, there was an overturned lamp on the floor. And, you know, it looked like a scene from a party. There was a coffee pot that was overturned on the floor.
Everything that the guy said happened, it must have happened because, you know, they're supporting evidence. There was an empty cake box, a half consumed pot of coffee, a half consumed cup of coffee, a bowl of cigarettes that were turned over.
It definitely seemed like there was some kind of violent action.
Yeah. Did you read? The thing that concerned me was that her clothes were pulled out of the drawers, and also the drawers were pulled out, and there was just clothes everywhere. Like someone had went through stuff.
I think they were looking for either drugs or money, maybe.
I do, too.
You know, and so when you think about the drugs or money part, it doesn't really go with Andrew, I don't think.
Well, this whole time he did think that she, too, was receiving these anonymous letters because that's what she told him. You know, when he said, I'm receiving threatening things, she said, oh, me, too. But during this time, law enforcement had taken her fingerprints and they matched the letters back to her. And he's finding out at the same time it's her.
And then she left a note, which was not a suicide note. It was more ramblings, such as all those things that she cut out in the threats. And, there was one that I saw, and it says, I'm just reading a part of it. And they'll say nice things behind my back. I guess I've been searching for an identity too desperately. Seize the nearest image, whether David, and doing things his way. And pointedly not compromising with my traditional way and using it versus my parents. And the David that she's referring to is David Lang. And he is a person that Irv always thought killed Karen.
Yeah, he is number one on Daddy's list.
And where was David? What was his alibi?
Well, he was off on a date with Natalie Wood, and she backs him up on it.
I know. Isn't this amazing? Everything kind of comes in. And David was known, I guess, in this apartment complex or whatever for going into neighbors' apartments when he was drunk.
Yes, he was a blackout drunk. He would just appear in people's apartments. And for the people that knew him, they would just say, you know, hey, David, get out. I guess if you didn't know him, that would be pretty spooky.
Yeah.
Did he end up in her apartment that night? I don't know.
He lived in the apartment below hers, correct?
Yes, correct.
So now, at the beginning, as you said, these letters, right? Because Karen had sent letters to herself in addition to the ones that she had sent to Andrew. So I guess to show Andrew, hey, look, I'm getting them too. And then that's when the police found, you know, all the prints and everything like that. And they even found the magazines and all of that. And the coroner said that her death was a murder because she had a broken hyoid bone. He had no doubts because it was a broken hyoid bone. Who recently had a broken hyoid bone, but it was ruled a suicide?
Exactly. And this is the case I looked at when Epstein's autopsy came up. This is exactly what I thought about because it is such a difficult bone to break, especially at Karen's age. You know, she's 22 years old. It is a strong bone. It normally takes a long drop, you know, and a lot of pressure. It is most commonly seen in manual strangulation homicides. That's just the way it is.
Now, after 3 days of being dead, the coroner says that the time of death was about 12:30 a.m.
Right, which is just about the time she was hanging up with Prime.
See, and so that kind of puts him out of it, you know, because, you know, I don't see that.
Because he couldn't have got over there so quickly.
But when you think about 12:30, but then if you go back to somebody else was talking about at 12, he got home from his date and called her and talked for 5 minutes. So then you're at 12:05. Then he has time to get over there. So, you know, I don't know if the police could tell at that time when calls ended and things.
I don't know. That's a good question because their technology was limited, but they didn't have cell phones. So, I mean, how far away did he live? And, you know, how could he have been over there so quick? And, you know, do we think it's weird that she was naked? You know, the guys who left to go to the Sunset Strip, they didn't mention that she was naked.
No. So, and she had been in bed, right? But right. Here's the thing. She went to bed. Maybe she got undressed before she went into bed. And, you know, they just left. They quietly left. So that could have been the case. Now, obviously, the door was unlocked. So she must have known who her killer was. Now, they originally said that the killer was left-handed, but none of the suspects they ever interviewed were left-handed.
Correct. So when the guys left to go to the Sunset Strip, they said they locked that door. So that puts her getting up, and then she had to unlock the door and let her assailant in. So she had to have known them.
Yeah. I mean, now, James Ellroy. I mean, I don't even know what this guy was thinking.
See, here we are full circle again. You know, these characters just keep coming up. I feel like he's going to be like Hodel.
Yes. Now. So he looks into this case for years, he said. And he says that, you know, he looked at the police record. He says that Karen was probably dancing naked when she slipped and fell, hit her throat on the back of a chair, and just somehow landed on the sofa. So,
again, she's 22. The hyoid bone takes a lot of pressure to break. And if you look at her autopsy report, I mean, her thyroid was just crushed, okay? That's a lot of force. She did not just fall on a chair, Ellroy.
Exactly. And your face is probably going to hit. You would have to be the most, and the chair, isn't the chair probably going to fall over or something? And if you hit it like that, and it didn't. But there were two sets of prints in the place, not belonging to any of the suspects. And you probably need to take a look at who those are. And none of the prints belong to Hathaway, the guy who had been there with Reuben for a while. So it's kind of odd that there weren't any fingerprints at all belonging to him.
Yeah, they were not able to match those to any of their top suspects.
Did he not have a drink? Did he not touch the TV? Did he not go to the bathroom? Did he not touch the doorknob? You know,
that's got to be bad police work because the guys that were in her home, I mean, they had cake, they had coffee. They were touching things.
Exactly. Coffee cups. The remote. She did not wash the dishes, you know? So, you know, it had to be on something, the silverware, whatever.
Not to mention what was scattered all around her, you know, 16 Kent cigarettes. So
I know.
The guys were in there smoking something. Those cigarette butts would have been great for DNA.
Exactly. So the police, to give them credit, for almost 6 or 7 years, they did interview Andrew and Reuben and Hathaway many, many times. And I think that Andrew, for the first year, was interviewed every week.
Yeah, they kept hauling them back in, thinking that they would remember something else or perhaps they could trip them up.
when Irv did his memoir, he said that he didn't think that Andrew had anything to do with Garen's murder. And he is the one, he said, we pretty much know who did it. But unfortunately, the police couldn't come up with the physical evidence to charge him. And the person he suspected was actor David Lang. But we didn't see any fingerprints of David up there at all, right?
Right.
But she knows him well enough to where she, in her rambling notes, she's talking about David and talking about things that, you know, should I do it his way or should we do it? So I think that they were closer than maybe people realized.
Yeah. If you're writing about the person in your notes, then yeah, you're close to them.
Yeah. And he was a very heavy drinker, a womanizer, lived right below. And he said that he got home around 12:30, very drunk and fell asleep. Did he go to his house? Oh, maybe he accidentally went to Karen's. And then she answers the door. She's naked, but she knows David and they've had a relationship. Perhaps at some point he does something, you know, they didn't do a rape test.
No, they couldn't, because after 3 days, the body was already decomposing, so there was nothing for them to test. Not that they had really the technology to do anything with any type of swab back then, but that's why they skipped it.
My guess is that he came up there. They knew each other, which is why she was willing to open the door naked. Maybe they had sex. Maybe, you know, they got into a fight after he was drunk and, you know, he ended up killing her. Possibly by accident. I do know that he, you know, the Langs had a lot of money. They're very wealthy, obviously, because they're living in this apartment complex too. And Irv believed that David's family had hired lawyers, really expensive lawyers, and then they refused the sheriff's department any kind of interviews with David at all.
Yeah, he's my top suspect. I do think that you're onto something about him coming back drunk, and then he maybe entered the wrong apartment, or he went looking for her because they've had a relationship, some type of relationship all along. You know, that
they had to have some kind.
Yeah.
Because you don't write that in the note where you're talking about it. Where you're talking, it sounds like they're in a relationship when you read it. Now, granted, none of her writings make any sense, but you know, the fact that she mentioned him in this and everything, I think it's kind of telling. But I don't know how many notes she was writing every day. And I don't, you know, there was other ramblings in that I didn't read that had nothing to do with David. A lot of them about her figure's fat and, I'll never be the way my mother wants it. I won't let it be what she wants. How stupid. I want to be slim and she loves me and wants me to be slim. Why must I be so alone? And then things like, why doesn't he want me? There's no God. You know, so it's, but she does say, or my Andy. But at the same time, she's talking about David.
Yeah, I think she loved Andy, but who better to find solace in than the guy downstairs, you know, Mr. David Lang. I tend to think that she went to this guy for comfort and she probably slept with him. You know, he's readily available. He's the womanizing drunk who is, you know, he kind of likes everyone.
And when I talked about it and she said, and using it versus my parents. And then she said, snubbing my nose at their way. And then always hate to be with them after a lengthy visit with quote unquote current boyfriend and their families. So again, this kind of says, this is her saying, I don't want to go home at Thanksgiving because I don't want to be with them after being with my current boyfriend and their families, a lengthy visit, which was probably the Palm Springs visit. And so, you know, that's kind of where I'm going. But to mention David like that, sees the nearest image, whether David and doing things his way and his had been underlined and pointedly not compromising with my traditional way. So I think that she's got a relationship with David and something happened that night. I think David killed her. And but we just don't know what were the circumstances.
I think he was drunk and she was just very strong-willed. She was known to be combative, and this is where I go back to talking about how the police said that she didn't have any enemies or anyone that would say anything bad about her. You know, yeah, but also no, because the people who worked with her at studio said that she was, you know, tough to get along with on set. You know, she was very opinionated. She would tell you off in a heartbeat. So if David came in and he was suggesting something she didn't want to do, could she be pushy? Yeah, and then maybe that's how they got into it.
Yeah. Irv and his wife were married for about 69 years, so that's quite something. And Irv was once offered a job as by the Chicago Tribune Syndicate. They wanted to know if he wanted to replace Hedda Hopper. But the job would require him to live in L.A., but the paper owned Hedda's house, and they said, well, you could live there and everything, and he didn't want to be in any the city where that had killed his daughter, so he turned down that job. And by the way, Dr. Penn Casey, it's Vince Edwards. That's his name. And they questioned him. They actually questioned him because of the fact that what Karen had done and serving him with the lawsuit. And she had tricked him into taking a subpoena. And he had apparently he was also mobbed up. So, you know, and he said that he became an actor rather than becoming a mobster. So he knew, you know, mobsters too. And he was also a gambler. And he often had no money because he gambled it all the way. And he would borrow from mob-connected bookies. And there was one time that one of them beat him up almost to the point of death. So, you know, this was a guy who also knew some people in the mob.
Yeah, so there's no shortage of people who could have done it. But at the end of the day, I just think that the simpler thing is that David Lang was right downstairs. You know, he was there.
I think that we should go with David. I'm happy with going with David. The time works. The timeline works. I think that they have some kind of relationship, so she's going to open the door to him, even though she's naked. They had sex or she was raped. And then some point something happened and he killed her.
Yep, that's what I'm going with. You know what else is creepy, though, is that Switzer Avenue that Karen was murdered on is also where Rebecca Schaefer was murdered. She was also an actress. But still.
No, she was more down by third, or closer to the Grove. And yeah, that was the one where the fan, right? And she opens the door and
her stalker.
Yeah. And then, you know, because of that death, I mean, that's where we get a lot of our stalker laws is because of her death. So, but that was tragic.
I mean, it was. So you have her and Karen and then also Natalie Wood. All three women are now dead. That's freaky.
It is. All right, Jen. Well, Merry Christmas. Thank you again for taking time on Christmas Eve. I really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And we should do one on New Year's Eve too. Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve.
All right. I'll be there.
Merry Christmas. I will talk to you
soon.
Merry
Christmas, honey. Merry Christmas, everyone. Bye.
Bye.